Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from inside a snow globe in a location we have yet to be here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
And with us today are our Clay Keller and I blew my joke. We've managed to do something that even Screen Drafts can't do. Yep, we've got Ryan Barker on the pod.
Good. I like this.
Have you guys both been nice guests to hear before you. On Not someone together. Else's podcast together? Oh.
We've done it a couple times.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here and there, but not
now
often.
Now I'm blanking, but we've definitely been on a show together before. Have we not done your show together before? Is this the first time we've done this?
No.
That's
no.
This is a true treat. This is a true treat. Yeah. This is a dream for us. Dream come true.
This movie's a treat.
It is a treat. Movie, I have a question, guys. For this episode, are you going to change your podcast art to be like the Apple like podcast logo and then it says like it's 1999 under it.
We're just gonna put an MP3 a picture of an MP3 rolling and then like 1999.
I've never seen that in a film before. That is like one of 8 million audacious things in this movie is the title insane. Screen is a close-up of an eye and then it says of the beholder.
You're getting way ahead of yourself. The reason Clay and Ryan are on this draft, feel free to listen to their brilliant episode on serial killer movies where they both state this movie is amazing or something. And Phil and I were like, I think you guys both said you both watched it, right? In anticipation of that draft.
A film incredible for a film that doesn't exist that Ryan and I had both watched it recently.
I'm also not convinced she's a serial killer.
Well, they both wanted to do this. They both mentioned that this film is crazy.
Yeah.
I believe they then said, have the 99 guys done it?
Right.
And immediately I texted Phil and I'm like
a bat signal.
I think we can get them both. here they are. These two suckers on to talk about this shitty ass movie.
Stop it. This is a great thing, movie.
I want to just, because Kenny, we've done a lot of bad movies on this podcast, right? And we've done a lot of misguided movies.
Yeah.
This is a whole other animal as far as I'm concerned. Because I watched this movie kind of in disbelief from credits to credits as to how not even inept it is, because it is inept. Like tonally, this director has no handle on the material, really whatsoever. But I don't know what movie the actors are in. I don't know why things, ultimately why things are happening. I don't, mm-hmm. the entire concept of this film about a man who watches a woman, just watches her for an hour 15 of an hour and 40 minute movie, is surprised mm-hmm. by her actions, does essentially nothing to thwart her. She is oblivious to opposite. Him following her.
It's the opposite. He protects her so she can kill more. This is the kind... This is partly right. This is like... This is, to me, this is on some Donald Kaufman the Three shit, where this is just one of those ideas where it's
trick
like,
photography.
What if it was a serial killer movie, yes. but the real serial killer was the guy watching the serial killer, right. and then like someone that, just bought
that's a
in.
Twist I would have liked.
Right.
If that twist had happened, this movie would go up like fucking 20, 30
that's,
points.
I'm not kidding you. That's what this movie is, unless Ryan has a different take. The movie is this guy is so enthralled with her that yes. he wants to protect her, but loves watching her kill people.
Is that your take, Ryan?
It's not. It's not. But I appreciate that take. I do like that take. I mean,
Ryan's like, this is a piercing psychodrama about a man with no who's lost his daughter. He's trying to find her in every woman that he meets.
Come on. This movie is very simply told.
Don't leave her. She's just a little girl.
Yeah. What the fuck is that?
I don't know, Phil. I don't know. The only thing we know about this lead character is that he hasn't seen his daughter in a while. That is literally the only thing we ever learn about him.
And who do we learn it from? Katie Lang.
Living in a bell tower for 7 months. How long is he up there? They renovate that entire space.
I have a bigger question. How long? What is the entire duration of this film? I have no idea what the passage of time is.
He calls out of work for like 2.5 years to follow this woman around the world
and watch her kill people.
All right, Ryan, I'd love to hear. tell us what this like. No joke, this movie is very funny to make fun of. But I also would like love to know you think is going on.
I mean, look, it's not surprising where we're all coming from with this movie. I mean, not saying this is a good movie, but this is a movie. I did watch it recently for that Serial Killers draft, watched it recently for this episode. And I watched this in 1999. This was definitely a late night viewing for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say it's a fucking great movie, but I will say that there is a weird audaciousness that I appreciate to this that I think like they don't really make anymore. Number one, this is I believe a Canadian produced movie, and I believe it as well. And as a lover of Canadian cinema, I definitely think that this has certain hallmarks of 90s Canadian movies, are sort of like. Yeah.
Ryan's going to start talking about Adam McGoyan.
It has an Adam McGoyan vibe, I'm just going to say.
Adam McGoyan is like, even Adam McGoyan's bad movies don't touch this shit.
Well, you know, again,
yeah, you have an actual Canadian on this podcast, okay? I'm not going to sit here and let you defame Canada while my Canadian friends.
Meanwhile, I'm trying to praise Canadian cinema. That's what I'm trying to do.
I hear you.
Obviously, this movie didn't come out in America until 2000. It was only released
in South Korea in 2000.
South Korea in 99, I would imagine.
I do want to piggyback on what you're about to say, Ryan, because I do think I think the Washington Post, okay, has, I think, a truly great review where they say this mangled project is neither great nor grand entertainment, but because it floors the pedal for both, it has a certain resplendent awfulness. And I think that's the best thing you can say about this film.
I mean, I guess so. Like, I don't know. I live now in a bit of an echo chamber where, like, all movies these days are either, like, you know, these big swings that hit or they miss completely. And this is just that kind of movie that came out at the time where mm-hmm. you didn't really have to invest a lot of mental energy. In fact, I think it discourages that. I think this is a late night, weird, like, kind of 90s noir, like, of the sort of, you know, sort of
I mean, there was a lot of like silk stockings type of vibe to this movie to me, where it's like, yeah, these are not like well-drawn characters, but I definitely think that they have part of it is the casting. I mean, look, Ashley Judd in the 90s, I'm in no matter
what. Double Jeopardy. Like,
good movie, bad movie. This movie is way better than a lot of the movies she made at the time, which, you know, like she made a lot of bad movies, in my opinion. And I think that this movie kind of fits into a specific era where I think she was trying to do different things. She was trying to sort of branch out into more interesting characters. This is not a good character by any means, but my God, like watching her fucking like kill people throughout the course of this, like in sexy lingerie while like screaming like Merry Christmas.
I think
Daddy.
We're getting to the heart of this right now. I think we're finally getting
sorry,
to the heart
I'm
of
in. I'm sold.
I have no problem with that. That was a nice moment for me too. And she really knows how to drive the knife. And I'm not just saying that. That was the when she killed that first guy, the guy who ostensibly is Ewan McGregor's target.
Isn't he just supposed to? Okay. Are we going to attempt to do the plot of this movie, or is that errand? Oh, okay.
We will attempt it. But it's very early in the podcast. Every step of that, guys. Stop running. Okay. All right, slow down.
All right.
All right. First of all, I just want to take issue with everything Ryan said. the only real thing is like, if you like this,
yeah,
I got like 15 from 99 that are better than this doing the thing you seem to like, including when we watched like last week, like Best Laid Plans is the movie you're describing.
Yes.
I love Best Laid Plans.
All right. It's so much better than this. I mean, but it's like this, like Best Laid Plans is a weird term I'm going to use, competent incompetence.
Correct.
In that, like, it does make a lot of mistakes.
Yes.
But all the mistakes are made in a way where you aren't ever like lost or like held at arm's length or left in a bell tower for hours and hours. Like, it's a very active movie and it's so fun and twisty. Yeah. This movie is like a true mess, like a true like splatter painting. And I don't even know where to start with it. But that's
well, can I just,
I mean, is I, it let's put I, it this way. Did you were you bored throughout the course no, of this
the
movie?
Entire no, movie. No. The entire movie.
You were totally bored.
Bored out of my mind.
Okay, well, that's you, surprising. I first, you that.
The first two kills were okay. And I was so bored and what particularly annoyed me was the way that they used the apparition or the specter of his daughter. Because it didn't illuminate anything. It was so exhausting and sweaty, and it meant nothing to this plot. So I felt like that girl was in 30% of the movie.
Yeah,
right. And it was
you
just,
could tell
what
at what point the filmmakers realized that she had no narrative reason to be there and that they were just slowing their production down by working around a child's hours the entire time. They were like, we're just get rid of her. She doesn't need to be in the rest of the movie because there's no explanation for why she suddenly there's no narrative turn. There's no realization. There's nothing that happens that would like cure him of her being there. She just disappears at some point.
I love that you love Best Laid Plans, though. That was a great moment for me.
Can I do want to say something, though, because I do think that I understand where you're coming from, Kenny, but I was so, quite frankly, flummoxed by this movie that I was not bored. Like, at no point was my attention not on the screen because I was just desperately trying to figure out how this even transpired. As opposed to, like, it's sort of what I said earlier. We've done bad movies, but sometimes they tip into a place where I tap out. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not in it anymore because
all the time,
it's so
all the time,
right? Like, I mean, Love Stinks, whatever, right? Like, there are just movies.
Wait,
where
wait
like,
till you
I,
watch Sympatica.
Okay, I can't wait. But great preview for our upcoming Sympatica episode. Bro. But I'll just say that this movie, because it is so completely unmoored, it is kind of a fascinating watch. Like, Ewan McGregor in this film, this to me was like, I was watching this thinking about how he kind of was on a razor's edge a little bit. His career almost got away from him, is kind of what I'm getting at, right? Like, Star Wars obviously was an enormous get, right? And Star Wars just, that's going to put you on the map forever, essentially, right? But prior to that, maybe, right? Sure, maybe not, sure. But like, I was just looking at his career, looking at his filmography earlier today as I was watching this film, just thinking like, how did we get here? And like, obviously he comes in through Danny Boyle, Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, right? Like, those make him a star. But then like, it's Velvet Goldmine, it's A Life Less Ordinary, it's like kind of getting away from him. And this movie as well, which comes out obviously before Star Wars. So this movie comes out in January. My apologies. It comes out after Star Wars. Yeah. Right. So January of 2000. So they're trying to ride his Star Wars, I guess, fame at that point. Right. But like, if it's not for Moulin Rouge, which I would argue is kind of the moment when I'm like, this guy can kind of do anything, I'm not sure that he had, like, this movie just to me shows in the wrong hands, this guy is bad.
I too looked at his filmography
when
I watched this, thinking the same thing. And it's not so much that he's bad. I mean, this movie's a mess, and we'll talk about it for the next hour and a half and how awful it is. He does this all the time. He makes bad decisions all the time throughout his career. He basically is two or three bad decisions for every one very good decision. and I kind of love him for it. I find him, a really kind of charming personality because of that. But this doesn't seem like a weird like misstep. This is just what he does every once in a while.
Yeah,
he's bland, but it's a. I mean, this is a bland part. I was like trying to think of if I could think of anyone, any of his contemporaries who would have made this interesting. And even his most interesting contemporaries, I don't think would have been able to do anything else with this particular character. He's either just watching Ashley Judd, or he's making excuses to Katie Lang, or he's saying the same kind of 12 lines over and over to his ghost daughter. Like, there's no depth to this character at all.
I completely agree with you. And I feel like the real, we're talking about like the DNA of this movie and why this thing doesn't work, as far as I'm concerned, is that your protagonist is inactive. Your protagonist is doing so little. And I don't even mean just physically. I mean, just in general, it feels like he is riding the coattails of another character.
He is.
And which is not interesting to watch, is my point, right? Watching someone watch someone is not an interesting thing, ultimately, as far as I'm concerned. I mean,
Vertigo would
Rear Window, sure. Like, there are examples of it, nail it, but like, right, more times than not.
But those characters in The Ones Where It Works, we have scenes with them doing other things, scenes with other people, scenes that give context to why they're watching somebody, things to that, you know, so when they're watching somebody, we have something that we're thinking about as well. We're not just also passive observers of the more interesting character, who's Ashley Judd, who is kept at arm's length distance the entire movie. Like, there's that whole detour. He goes to talk to Genevieve Bujold.
Oh, it's the best.
And it's a 20-minute thing. And the conclusion is she was abused. And then he's like, okay. And it's like, we knew that. A savvy viewer could pick up from what we've seen thus far that that's probably what was going on.
The thing is, there is a, if this movie, for instance, was directed by Brian De Palma, right? This movie could have been fucking great. It would have been 10 times more violent. It would have been way more violent. It would have been way more sexy. Everything would have just been dialed the fuck up. And the whole thing would have just been like almost camp.
But no, I disagree with that strongly. But
I think Femme Fatale is a great movie that's kind of similar to this fucking movie, quite frankly. Well, totally.
I do think Femme Fatale is a great movie. I don't think it's that similar to this movie. I do think there's a world where, I guess, De Palma takes something like this and really makes it camp. But like, this movie fucking,
or at least visually more interesting. Like, that's the thing. I mean,
there's not a lot here. You know, like, really, there's almost nothing here except for a really screwed up understanding of why we empathize with characters. Mm-hmm. And I think that really puts the viewer in a very strange place all film. I mean, Phil, the greatest period of our lives, me and you, Phil, was when we recorded this podcast. No, really, truly, you'll agree with me. When we were assistants in Hollywood, and they were still giving out pilots on DVDs. Yes. Am I right? That was the best. The
greatest time. Yeah.
We used to get all the DVDs of pilots that got picked up and the ones that didn't. Yes. So we have seen more failed pilots than anybody who has not worked at a network, I think, in the world, because we used to just steal them. Yes. This reminds me of so many failed pilots I used to watch.
Yes.
In that, but the difference is like in a pilot, you assume you're going to have 100 more episodes to develop your characters, but they always have these like, you have to get out what he does in 10 minutes. All right, he works for British intelligence, but he has a new thing today. And you can't see the you can't see the motivation of the antagonist right away, because you'll find out eventually. Like her, you know, I mean, this new fucking show with Miranda Bacharin or Bacharin is that idea. It's like,
the
end game. She's a villain. We don't know why. We'll tell you in 100 episodes.
Right. It's like that James Spader show.
Yeah, the Blacklist. Like, they did it over and over and over and over. I mean, House, why is he such an asshole? You'll find out eventually. Why does he limp? We don't know. We'll find out eventually. But in this movie, they tell you the last fucking, in the beginning of Act 3.
Yeah.
And it's just everything is rushed because there's no character development done on the front side. And that's
but also the answer is deeply uninteresting.
Of course it is, dude. Of course it is, because they had to give it to you in 1 second because they did no work on the front. It connects to nothing.
But I also just feel like, there is, here's the thing. Joanna's character, the Ashley Judd character, there's potential there. I think it's wasted, but there's potential.
Always potential in a hot serial killer.
Sure. I don't even mean it in that regard, but I just mean in the sense of someone that is, you know, someone that's dealing with trauma, someone that's dealing with it in an unorthodox way, obviously. But like, part of the problem is that whenever you do get scenes with Joanna, she's unhinged in kind of bizarre ways, in ways that you're just sort of unclear as to like how this, am I supposed to feel sorry for this person? Am I not, like, am I supposed to be afraid of this person? It's all wishy-washy. It's both our protagonists in this film are so muddy and so mushy that you're just like, I don't really understand what I'm supposed to be invested in. Like when they finally meet and have a drink together at the end. And I was just like, finally, these two people are interacting. And it's just, it's basically platitudes. It's just like vague kind of conversation between two people that at that point I was like, this should be like the fucking scene from Heat. This should be like the two fucking people that have been circling each other. It's just, and it's
McGregor, Judd, finally meeting.
Exactly.
We've been waiting for 20 years.
I think that, I don't know. Listen, I'm not really riding for this movie, Kenny.
I know you're not.
Because poor Ryan over there decided to take up the pro Eye of the Beholder stance from the beginning. I will say I liked it more the second time. I liked it more when I watched it 2 days ago than when I watched it 6 months ago, just by virtue of having correct expectations this time around. I knew that this movie was insane. I knew it made no sense. I knew it was, as everything Phil was just saying, it is so like muddy. Yeah. And I if you just kind of watch it as a odd, nearly like montage-esque, like MTV meets art house late 90s aesthetic thing.
Sounds so good, Clay. You nailed this.
It is
so perfectly
more entertaining. Now, I am not going to get anywhere approach saying that this movie is good, but I was shocked to find on the second time I watched it that I was shocked to watch it a second time, first of all. Yeah. And I was shocked that the second time I watched it, I wasn't bored like Kenny was. I was just kind of like, this is when you get to just sit back and accept it for what it is. You get to have the fun thing of noticing even more things that don't make sense in
Can I ask a question?
Which is, it just turns into a game of accumulating nonsense.
This is a genuine question.
Yeah.
What is Ewan McGregor's job?
No clue. He's some kind of government sponsored surveillance.
Don't pretend like that's okay. You can't be like, yeah.
No, but.
I mean, he's British intelligence. He might be a PI.
Is he? He's the worst fucking spy I've ever seen in my life.
Totally. You're absolutely right about all these
things. Okay, like, the opening scene, he is spying on some guy having sex with his secretary or something.
Yeah.
In the building across the street from the building he works in?
Correct.
What?
With a giant gun-like microphone thing?
With a giant gun, awesome. With a giant gun camera.
I see what's happening here, guys.
Do you?
Yeah, I see what's happening here. I think Clay just nailed it. If your expectations are rock bottom,
yes,
then you can, you know, the little like ridges in the rock look like things that might be exciting. But for us who watched this movie the first time last night, I was sitting there mouth agape. And I took notes, and I don't really take notes anymore because I've been doing this too long and I'm exhausted. But I took notes, and my notes.
You know who does take notes?
I know you do, me. Buddy. You're the beating heart of this podcast. I wrote things like movies are hard because like
movies are hard.
I thought that too, though.
I really thought that. I'm like, yeah, like yeah. This isn't like that far off.
I know,
but like it's hard to get everything right. Yeah. And I think movies who do get it right deserve credit.
There are
movies that get them wrong. Yeah. Other things like, I'm like, some movies seem effortless. And yeah. This seems like the exact opposite, where it feels like they fucking worked so fucking hard to get the ball across midfield. Yep. You know those teams that spend the whole fucking game getting sacked in their own half and then finally get the ball in the field goal range?
Right.
That's what this field felt like to me. Like they worked so hard to put together something that was compelling. And like
the end of this movie, Kenny, feels a lot like a 60-yard field goal that like bonks off of the uprights. Yeah,
it feels like this movie is a.
They're like,
doink.
We're gonna send him to Alaska. We're gonna put him together.
And I guess the reason, like, and again, like, I'm going to like rescind all of my criticism from the beginning because the fact that you guys are watching for the second time with a different set of. Or third in Ryan's case, with a different set of expectations, I do think would color my view differently. But watching it the first time, my feeling was like it was I had a weird amount of contempt for this movie.
Sure. Oh, for sure.
Because my feeling was like, oh, you think you're good? You think you're making a masterpiece here? Like, I don't think this was. I don't think there was any fun. I was like, there were too many like. Big swings and big ideas and you know, things that are formally out of the norm that you don't make those decisions unless you think you're breaking cinema in some way. And I felt like you think I'm an idiot, that you think like him talking to his like dead ghost daughter is revolutionary.
Alive daughter, just he hasn't seen her in a bit. But I'll just say this.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Like, no, 100%. Two things come to mind as you were talking. The first about the movies are hard thing. I found myself watching this thinking about all of us have been on sets, I'm assuming at one point or another. And that moment when you're either sitting at Video Village and a director is able to like do an assembly essentially in their head where they're sort of like, they know how it's all going to kind of piece together. And I'm not a person that can do that yet, maybe someday, but I find that really impressive. And yet at the same time watching this, I'm like, oh, none of this fits together. Like none of this, you saw a movie in your head that there was no way in that actually coming to fruition.
It's like a less than beautiful mind.
The least beautiful mind.
It's just one of those things where like, I see that he was just like, oh, we'll do like this, and it's going to be perfect. And I think this is this director who's made one good film in his life.
It's a very good movie though. I think Adventures of Priscilla Quinn is a great movie.
Yeah, he's made a good movie. So he's done it before.
He's capable. Exactly.
And I think that he got a certain amount of hands-off treatment by producers. But this one doesn't come together for me. All right, I'm going to shut up for a while.
I want to just give context because I'm sure that not many of our listeners have actually seen this film. And by the way, don't watch this movie. Just a disclaimer.
Or if you do, watch it again immediately. Yeah. Yeah. Only watch it for a second time if you can.
Watch this movie immediately.
Yes, get your first watch out of the way immediately.
This movie is available on every free streaming site possible, so it's readily available.
It is literally available on Pluto, Tubi, IMDb TV and Fubo. Yeah.
It's yeah. And so, it's on Prime too, right? So you don't even have to watch it with ad breaks.
Oh, correct. I got it. Oh, they Amazon sent me where it's IMDb TV.
And anyway, I didn't watch it with ad breaks.
Anyway, long story short, British spy Stephen Wilson, played by Ewan McGregor, known as The Eye to his employers, is training Paul Hugo for
why
an assignment.
Why did they use his eye? They should just use his face.
What did you say? Is training?
I'm just reading the Google synopsis, guys.
Okay.
Is known as The Eye to his employers, is trailing, sorry, my apologies, trailing Paul Hugo for an assignment when he witnesses Paul being murdered by his girlfriend, Joanna Iris. I never really know how they pronounce it. It's kind of, I'm just going to Iris.
Why would they not call her Iris? Like
it's Iris.
No, it's Iris.
Why would they not call her Iris?
Because they're calling Eric Clay, the
Eye. Why would she not be Iris? But they're too classy to call her Iris.
Yeah, it was a little much.
Haunted by the breakup of his marriage,
Joanna Eyelid.
Haunted by the breakup of his marriage and by his absent daughter Lucy, Steve notices Joanna's resemblance to his child. That's bullshit. There's no resemblance whatsoever.
No,
and decides to protect her. This is another thing. Make Lucy a teenager or something like that. So at least the stretch is not like a fucking 7-year-old to or however old. Anyway, Steve notices Joanna's resemblance to her child and decides to protect her as Joanna wanders the United States. Steve follows and destroys evidence of her multiple killings. Sure. Eye of the Beholder opened at the Venice Film Festival on September 4th, 1999. It later opened wide.
How
on
long
January.
Of a standing ovation, Phila, does it say?
It was 20 minutes.
Oh, my God. It opened 20 minutes.
Wide on January 28th, 2000. And we go into
this. This is the same Venice Film Festival that exists today?
Correct. correct.
Real come up for them.
It would go on to make $17 million on a $35 million budget. It was number one at the box office opening weekend, the Super Bowl weekend, grossing $6 million in its opening weekend. But it fucking cratered after that. And domestically, it only made $1.1 million internationally, which I think is kind of crazy, actually. I expected this film to actually like perform overseas. Right. Just based
it seems
on,
like something like the French would like.
Or even like just, you know, Danny Boyle fans would be like, oh, Ewan McGregor's in it. Anyway.
Right.
It's got 9% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 32% from audiences. CinemaScore gave it a rating of F based on surveys from general audiences. It's notable for the first film in over 15 years to receive an F grade. I think we've had several since, but at the time, it was the first in 15 years.
I looked it up. They started rolling off after this one. Yeah, it audiences feels like that, just stopped caring. I mean, some of them are like in the cut, got an F. That's some crazy. Of them are like, yeah, that's some of them are crazy. Great movies. But this is the first since Razzie winning film Bolero to get an F.
So I'm just going to read three little clips of reviews. Peter Travers in Rolling Stone said, in trying to both inflame and induct our morbid curiosity, Elliot fails to make the needed connection between the audience and a peeper who has lost his moral balance. I just like that he used the word peeper. New York Times called it an impenetrable mess of a movie. And the Village Voice said, it's neo-noir, psych thriller signifiers don't just provide goofy flash via flashback, but service a grief-concerned narrative in which time and space collapse into a surrealist black hole.
Cool. Sounds great.
I mean, that sounds cool, right?
I mean, that's what I saw. I don't know. I don't know what everybody else is looking at.
I'm starting to think, like, the more I think about this movie, that maybe there is, like, this... All right. This also reminds me of a lot of bad spec scripts I've read in my life. But because people who wrote specs in the 90s and early 2000s were obsessed with serial killers and murders and different ways to like get people murdered.
And noir. Hardboiled.
The whole decade.
Yes. People like that. It was we've done it all. And now let's think of another way. But there is a Gone Girlish version of this.
Oh, yeah.
There is like a version where they really actually lean into this idea that he finds it like sexually titillating. Not this ridiculous, like, she reminds me of my daughter, therefore I must help her kill and survive. This like thing, which is like, we know that you are into Ashley Judd in her lingerie murdering people. So is this guy. And then they could have, you know, had him you know, like fucking, you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
And then continue it in order to continue like getting off based on what this woman is doing. And then you start to really get into the idea of voyeurism and male gaze and what exactly we're doing in this society and who's to blame. But I think they've muddied up what could be an interesting like idea. Like I mean, I love Gone Girl so deeply and so much. Because I think Gone Girl kind of plays with this idea too, but Gone Girl isn't the same kind of movie. But the idea that the man is complicit in like in the violent actions of the woman is an interesting one that you don't really see. Like Monster, for instance, a great film, has nothing to do, you know, like men are only, you know, guilty in that she's been abused. But it is more interesting to me, this idea of like literally thousands of years of men finding women being violent, sexually appealing, attractive, titillating.
Well, but
that could have been played a little more.
It feels like it wants to have its cake and eat it too, though, right? Which is that like you've got that scene in the bathroom where he's like touching the wall and she's on the other side in the bathtub, and like there's definitely a sexual energy there. But then it's like this father-daughter thing. Just get rid of the kid. Like, the kid is really just unhelpful.
Get rid of the kid.
There's no reason that kid should be there. Just one of the most profound missteps I've ever seen in a movie.
That's really what it comes down to. Without like, the kid, maybe I love this movie.
That, like, just for... Yeah, you guys, for 30% of the... For 40 minutes, his only interactions are this little girl, like, jumping around, going like... Hey, Daddy. And he's like, no, you're not real. And she's like, protect her. She's just a little girl. And you're like, I don't, what? Like, in the most base terms, as Kenny was saying, this is ruining the vibe. This is killing my vibe for sure. And it's also just, it doesn't make any sense. And it is, I don't know why the girl is there. Like you said, Phil, him thinking that Joanna resembles his daughter...
Nonsense.
Physically is not in the movie, I feel like.
It is only in the photos. There's like this moment when he's looking at the photos of her, the first photos he takes.
And the one...
he keeps saying Lucy.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. The ages make this confusing. Because Ashley Judd is the same age as Ewan McGregor, if not older than him. Correct. So like the daughter thing is strange. Now, I have not read the book, obviously. It's based on a book. And there was a French film in the early 80s where it seems like it's Isabella Gianni is the killer woman. And then the guy is like a 50-year-old dude. And Isabella Gianni is probably 20-something. Yeah. Like, so if they're doing the daughter thing there, maybe that makes a lot more sense. But even if you're doing the daughter thing, having, you know... traumatizing it via this apparition is just about the stupidest way you could do it.
It makes me wonder. Now, I'm going to guess that the daughter thing was in the novel that was in the French film. Yeah. Whatever. Let's just guess it was. It makes me feel like they misunderstood what they were doing there. And what I think they might have been doing is something that the French might be more comfortable with than Americans, but the the sexualization of younger women and little girls, and the conflation of women of all ages being, you know, kind of looked at as girls. I think I watched Breathless pretty recently, and I think that there is some kind of weird shared DNA with the idea of an older criminal teaching a younger person like the his ways. Yep. And I think that's the thing we've seen a lot. And Phil, we've got to see it like be a disaster, like with Entrapment. But that thing works and like should work in a really creepy, unsettling way. Mm-hmm. Not like Entrapment, where I think you're supposed to think like these two are perfect for each other, and like this is how they fuck. I don't know.
But I watched the scene when she murders the guy at the beginning like twice because I thought I misheard her say. Does she not say "Merry Christmas, Daddy" or something like that?
That's the line.
That's what she said.
Why?
Well, it's Christmas. It's Christmas time for several scenes of this movie and sometimes scenes that are separated by other stuff, which makes, like, again, this, yeah, that review that said this is like a collapsed black hole of time and space is absolutely accurate, because I think we go through at least two, if not three, Christmases over the course of this film.
Is that including the one she had in the alleyway as a little child?
Oh, not including that one. So it's, yeah, like four or five Christmases.
Have you considered she's just testing out catchphrases?
Can I just say, Eye of the Beholder is a Christmas movie. I hope you bring that up in December and on Twitter and see what people think about that, because this is a Christmas movie.
Eye of the Beholder is a Christmas movie.
What are you guys doing next year for Christmas? I'm sure you know. I'm sure you know, Clay. Like, what are you doing? Because you've run the gamut. Oh no, for Screen Draft they do.
Us fans,
us diehards, us draft heads over here.
We'll figure it out. We have not done Christmas horror yet.
Interesting.
Clay, I'm just curious. What do you provide as evidence that this was multiple Christmases? I'm just curious.
I didn't take timestamps on the scenes, but just watching it the other night, I noticed that there was Christmas and then another big, and it's Christmas at the end of the movie again. Like, it is
right.
It's not Christmas. Clearly, okay. So there's clearly
this is
big,
important.
I just don't
for
see it as
clearly
a year thing.
There's clearly. When they're in San Francisco for a while, he follows her to San Francisco. There's this empty, barren storefront, and the blind guy is like, I'm going to make this your store. And then it's completely redesigned. It's all built out. There's at least a few months there. It's not all one Christmas season. Like, they're out there for a minute.
She's in Alaska for a while. She's a fucking waitress for a while.
I guess I just don't get the idea, like, that Merry Christmas Daddy meant it's Christmas. To me,
well,
I didn't really
there's
get
Christmas
that.
Decorations in the city and things. There's Christmas stuff around. Sure. It's Christmas time.
But is she saying that because of the flashback of this horrible Christmas she had?
Well, here's the thing. Like, this is like fucking like nickel store psychology in this movie. Like, it is so...
It's pennies.
It's penny store psychology.
Dime store won't even stock this shit.
It's so uninteresting. Where it's just, yeah, it's... And it's... They don't even let you figure out he's got an estranged relationship, doesn't know his daughter, she's got this thing. They have the fucking ghost girl 9 minutes in say, Daddy, protect her, she's just a little girl like me. Like, how fucking dumb do you think the audience is?
Wow.
Plus, then there's no mystery. Even if the whole thing was, it would still be boring if this was a mystery. Like, why is he protecting her? And then it's like, flashbacks, dun, dun, dun. She didn't have a father figure, so she went wayward. And he isn't taking care of his daughter. That's boring as hell. But the way they do this, it gives away the boring twist 9 minutes in.
I don't think 1999 was equipped to handle what we want this movie to be doing. I think times before it and times after it were, but that's one thing. Two, I'm really sensing, Ryan, I'm sensing that you don't think we're being respectful of this movie.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's a bad movie for sure. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't really, it's low hanging fruit. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, easy to pick on this particular movie. I don't think, I mean, it's like you said earlier, Kenny, this is hard work, and this comes from a time when making movies was harder work.
Sure.
And nowadays, like, you watch a bad movie and it basically feels like, oh, no one worked here. They just basically shit this movie out. This doesn't feel like that.
Right.
This feels like a noble failure. You know, it's an adaptation of a book that totally failed. But it has, for me, so many great aesthetic things in it. And maybe it's because you guys live in 1999 and, I don't anymore. And honestly, to me, I've just spent, you know, so much of the last 6 months watching brand new movies that I'm like, yeah, it was pretty good. Not too bad. You know, it's okay. I don't feel very much about things, a lot of new movies anymore.
Are you dead inside, Ryan?
In a way, in terms of the modern context of movies and just the excitement of trying to get excited even about a bad movie.
I hear you, dude. I completely hear what you're saying.
This movie is gorgeous from top to bottom. It's beautifully filmed, beautifully photographed. Again, uses real places, not
I do like soundstages. The globe-trotting aspect of it.
I do too.
It has two actors that I do appreciate.
The snow globe trotting. Yes, thank you, guys.
I appreciate the quirkiness of a Ewan McGregor role circa late 90s. Sure. I also appreciate the same of Ashley Judd. I love the weird Jason Priestley part. There are just,
That's the best part of the movie.
We'll have to talk about that.
We'll talk about that.
It's not so much a pushback around. I hear everything you're saying. And I do think so much of where we're missing each other on this has to do with perspective. I think the fact that Phil and I have seen so many movies in 1999 versus you who haven't, and you've seen so many movies of recent vintage, I have not.
Well, it's also that I have the nostalgia of this. So when I watch this movie, I think of the time when this was like, oh, yes, this is a bad movie, but boy, we stayed up till 2:30 watching it because it's so batshit insane.
But
in great ways and in kind of terrible ways, you know, like there is that nostalgia towards it.
Yeah. And I totally understand. Because I think the other main difference that I have is I don't find this movie fun, but, and you kind of have to find it fun to have that, you know, stamp lathe thing. But I guess my big difference is like, I don't see this as a noble failure. I see it as an ignoble failure. And, a lot of that is just contrasting it with the movies I do think are noble failures, you know? And I do think that like, if I need, you know, if I want to ride for a film, you know, like Best Laid Plans, I do feel like I need to kind of acknowledge, and I didn't really ride that hard, but I rode for it very hard as a noble failure.
Sure.
Right? Like, think it was like, this is not working, but I love how hard it fucking tried.
Well, can I ask you a question, Kenny? Who's worse? Which performance is worse, Ewan McGregor or Josh Brolin?
No one's worse than Josh Brolin in Best Laid Plans. No one's ever been worse. Katie Lang acts circles around him. And I'm not joking.
She is bad in this movie.
It's such bad casting. It really depresses me.
Speaking of Best Laid Plans, let me drop an idea I just had on.
Please.
Recast this movie.
Yes.
Reese Witherspoon.
Yes.
And Nicolas Cage.
Sure.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
In 99?
In 99.
Yeah. What's Cage in 99? Does he do? Yeah, he did Bringing Out the Dead. And
Gone in 60 Seconds?
Yeah, 8 Mile. Sorry.
Nick Cage was kind of working in this arena.
I like the...
I just think it makes more sense. If you're doing the daughter thing, it just makes more sense with an older guy. And you maybe don't necessarily make it erotic or make it that an uncomfortable angle of
make
it or something.
It super fucking erotic.
It's super erotic.
But like but very, like, in a very uncomfortable way.
That narratively... tracks.
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something. Frankly, I wouldn't recast Ashley Judd. Cause she's been in so many movies like this where she plays the damsel or she plays the ass kicker. And I think that was what I was most compelled by going into this film. The idea that, oh, Ashley Judd is playing the serial killer. That is new and different. And I found that interesting. And I also think it potentially in the right hands, I don't think this movie does it, but potentially kind of subverts a trope.
Sure.
I would have gone a lot older with the Ewan McGregor character, to your point. I think that if you go 50s,
like a Liam Neeson?
You know,
50s and 99. No, weirder than Neeson, I'm thinking. Not, I'm thinking not more Nevish than Neeson. What'd you say?
Terrence Stamp.
Damn, what?
Okay. No, I mean, like, the guy is fucking Harvey Keitel. If you put Harvey Keitel in that role, I think the movie plays. But you know,
Jim Broadbent.
But then again, Phil, this is very similar. I mean, a much more successful version of this is Holy Smoke.
Yep. So I want to just piggyback on what you were saying, Ryan, about the nostalgia. Wait,
Ryan gave me a look.
No. That's totally true. This is Holy Smoke, and bears a lot of the same problems as Holy Smoke does. And it's sort of strange. To me, the big problem with this movie, and you know, we can kind of quibble about the stupid plot points, but in the end, like, it's kind of this you know, faux psychological thriller. So I kind of feel like, you know, the whole point of this movie, I think from the get-go, is that both characters are mysteries. And, you know, eventually they'll overlap. And what is the things that are bringing them together? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's sort of a basic story. It's nothing too compelling in that regard. However, I do think that, like, what I like about this movie is the fact that it's not, you know, here is the character from A to B, and, like, you know them from beginning to end within the first half hour. I like the fact that there's strangeness, there's a mystery to the whole thing. It sort of unfolds in a strange and bizarre way, in the way that Holy Smoke does. And by the end of Holy Smoke, you come to, like these characters to a certain degree. With this movie, you don't. But I don't think that they are dissimilar in the way that you kind of are approaching the film, very kind of bizarre place. You don't know where you're at kind of in the beginning of both films. And by the end, you sort of do, but it's not so fucking paint by numbers, you know, psycho thriller. Like, I definitely think that this movie, you're right, it's trying to do something ambitious, but in the end, it's sort of a very small movie. I mean, there's a very small thumbprint to this movie.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about Jane Campion versus a director whose name I don't know.
Totally, but of course.
But I think, Stephen Elliott? You know, Stephen Elliott, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Campion also is known for taking big swings, and sometimes they don't work, and sure, that's okay. It's totally fine. Jane Campion is clearly a great filmmaker that has, you know, developed the cachet to allow her for those. But, you know, again, In the Cut isn't a great movie. I love it. It's bizarre. It's crazy. But it's not exactly,
but that's the movie that this movie wants to be, is ultimately.
Definitely.
What
and Stephen Elliott is not Jane Campion. However,
I think we're all kind of saying similar things, which is, I think at the end of the day, if I don't like a Jane Campion movie, my guess is I'm probably wrong. And I'm, you know, like, my guess is I have to try a little harder. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's true for In the Cut. And I think that was true for Holy Smoke. And I think that's true for a lot. Even The Piano, it takes a lot more mental energy to figure out what she's getting at. And then you get there. I think Holy Smoke's a really good example because I think she lands that plane.
Yes, totally.
Right? Like, that's a plane and that is fucking wobbling on its way down. But this guy.
But Kenny, can't you see that, like, if you're seeing a movie like that, and we're put yourself in 1999, 1998,
2000.
If you see that's the vibe of the times, and that's the kind of movie, like, people are making, and it's a very exciting type of movie. I mean, it's definitely a noir. This movie is trying to be noirish to a certain degree, or a psychological thriller in the sort of, you know, late 90s era that, I mean, Femme Fatale is a perfect comparison, to be quite honest, because you're totally right. They are very, very similar, and they fail spectacularly similarly, like, in my opinion. I think they both kind of, one is trying to be sexy, the other is weirdly trying not to be sexy, and yet they both kind of fail in their ability to develop tension between your characters.
But Femme Fatale is sexy, and Antonio Banderas has about 4 billion times more personality than... Right. Ewan McGregor. Like, I don't disagree.
Plus, his job is photography.
Really?
His job is to be at a distance.
He does.
In the Antonio Banderas world.
The most famous GIF in the world. He has so much personality that a little snapshot of it is the most made thing on the internet.
Kenny is doing the GIF.
Kenny's doing
it
to remember it.
GIF.
Yeah, you nailed it. Sure.
Ryan, you're not wrong. You say, like, I don't want a movie.
I'll give you that 5 seconds.
I don't want a movie to give me the outline of the character in the first 5 minutes with some bad exposition dump or something, but we should know they should have something, some kind of personality or somebody to talk to or something.
Why?
Something.
What do you need?
Because then why are we watching them? The scenes are boring.
No, you don't need. You don't need it.
You need that? Do you need that every single time?
For the characters to have a character? Yeah.
Of course, you don't. You're both crazy. You're both nuts.
I love this so much.
Neither of these things have to happen in movies.
It's called a character, right?
Yeah, I got that. And there are so many movies with characters. This happens to be one without them. And you know what? I'm okay with that. That's life.
There's
you know?
So many movies with
Ryan
characters.
Puts this movie up with Derek Jarman's Blue. It's this and Blue. It's like some movies have characters and plots, and some don't. And that's also valid.
I love it so much.
Yeah. Well, it is also valid. I think that where I kind of, you know, differ or just go our separate ways is In 1999, after, you know, 20 years of the erotic thriller, mm-hmm. none of this seems even remotely outside of what has been happening, and nor does it seem like it's commenting on what's been happening. So this to me is a very rote attempt or a rote entry mm-hmm. in the erotic thriller canon that's misguided in all the, you know, all the wrong ways, like all the ways in which it tried to be different, I think have just backfired or misfired. Mm-hmm. So I'm not taken with in any way with the ambition, because I don't think it's particularly ambitious within the context of its time. That's what
I hear where you're all coming from. And I do think that, you know, to Ryan's point, I don't disagree with the movie A that you're seeing or the movie that you wish you saw to some degree. I think we're all kind of coming at this in a different way. But I do think that part of one of the problems this movie has, and because I'm looking at a poster for Eyes Wide Shut, and I'm thinking that there is almost a dreamlike component to this film in terms of this kind of psychosis and these hallucinations mm-hmm. and the what have yous. This movie needed a constricted timeline. Part of the problem of this film is it's unwieldy in its time. So you're losing all of that suspense, all of that sort of, you know, is she going to get away with it? Is he going to find all that kind of stuff keeps dissipating because you're just like, how much fucking time has gone by?
Yeah,
and he keeps checking in with K.D. Lang. Like, it's losing. So I understand why, like, I was never bored necessarily, but I certainly found myself being like, why is this playing out the way it's playing out?
You know what it weirdly reminded me of while I was watching it? Mm. Lee Daniels' other movies. The ones that the Paperboy,
sure.
and the one with Cuba Gooding Jr.
and Helen Mirren. Yeah, that makes
his weird. Shadow Boxer.
His movies that, like, you know, like all of his movies are, you know, batshit. Even the fucking Butler's batshit. Yeah. But there's a certain beauty to me in The Paperboy, sure. and in Shadowboxer in its total fucking wackiness. But
right.
those movies in particular seem so much less afraid of being outside the mainstream than this one does.
Well, I would also say too that, you know, when you were, Ryan, talking about sort of the nostalgia of this, I kept thinking about a conversation we had a little bit, Kenny, when we were doing our Best Laid Plans episode, which was the sort of straight-to-video thriller that existed. And by the way, this movie kind of falls into that too, because, like, it basically craters at the box office.
Can we take a quick two-hour break so I can go watch Best Laid Plans?
You're going to like, feel behind the curve on a lot of these conversations.
You will like the movie.
No, I'm sure I will.
Where was it? On Crackle?
It's on Crackle, I think.
Of course.
But my grander point was crackling. More about the fact that we talked about Best Laid Plans, and then we talked about Deep Water. And we talked about how Deep Water is a prime example of a movie that just essentially doesn't exist anymore, right? It went straight to Hulu for a myriad of reasons, the biggest one being that it's expensive to release a movie in theaters right now and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But more than anything, I watched this film and was thinking about what you're saying, Ryan, about, like, this type of thriller really doesn't exist anymore. And that's disappointing. And obviously we should, you know, collectively, the four of us need to fix that. But right. I do think that this film is just, it's pretty inept at what it's trying to do. It's not to say that I didn't find it compelling and interesting to watch, but more than anything out of bewilderment than out of an actual genuine kind of investment in what was going on. But I found myself, like, Ashley Judd's wigs, for instance, like, I just kept being taken out of it, and not in like an American's kind of way where, like, their wigs were always kind of ridiculous, but it kind of worked and you were just like, this is fun. Her wigs are just atrocious. And you're just like, I don't understand how anyone is not. It's just all this kind of espionage shit just doesn't work.
Like, that's what you said, Phil, is it's got this sort of, like, heightened sort of dream logic thing to it. I want to say two things. One, I compared having being bland and having no plot and characters to Derek Jarman's Blue. I just looked up Blue because and I had an incorrect notion of what the movie Blue was, and I don't want to. I want to correct the record. For some reason in my head, I thought it was some sort of, like, experimental, like, museum piece where they just showed a blue screen. Apparently it's a soundscape with all these things happening, and it's like about the AIDS crisis. So I want to take back what I said about Blue, because I misunderstood what that movie was.
Okay, fair point. What's your other point?
My other point. Thank God you said that.
I know, right? The other thing I want to say is, yeah, the other weird, this weird dream logic to this movie, which like my roommate pointed out, like they go to the train station and everybody is dressed in like suits, like it's the 30s or something, and people have on fedoras. It's got this weird pseudo until the end of the world vibe to it, where like it's like Ewan McGregor's got a briefcase fucking Skype setup that is.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of Skyping in this
so
movie.
Far advanced. When he hooks in his laptop into the fucking dial-up phone on the airplane, he's getting like 720p resolution in 1990. Like, there's a lot of that, like pseudo sci-fi stuff on the fringes of this movie, and stylistic things and some stuff where you're like, this doesn't feel like it is literally in our time and our place. And it's another thing that just kind of, as you said, Phil, unmoors the entire project, and it is like it just makes it all the more confusing of what it is trying to do and what it thinks it's accomplishing. Because as we've all said, it's not sexy particularly, because all the sexy stuff is undercut. It's not a incisive psychodrama. It's not like I said, I enjoyed it the second time more because it is this collection of kind of odd stylistic things and weird flourishes and kind of things you can just gawk at. But it is not a successful movie. But I did watch it, Phil, to bring it to what you just said. I watched it with my girlfriend and my roommate in a double feature with Deepwater.
There you go.
We watched Deepwater, then we watched this. And I was really struck by the similarities.
Now I can't wait to watch Deepwater. I'll just say this, though.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No, I haven't either.
Oh, interesting.
What was the name of the Matt Damon, Emily Blunt movie, The Something Bureau?
The Adjustment Bureau.
Mm-hmm. This kind of felt a little bit like that in a weird way. But in the aesthetic that you're talking about of this, like, what... Where are we in time? Mm, there's kind of this weirdness.
That's so generous to this movie.
Well, but I like the Adjustment Bureau.
Yeah, that's a film.
I'm a defender of the Adjustment Bureau.
About the Adjustment Bureau is...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Does that... Because
no, you brought the Adjustment Bureau. That's why we're talking about it.
I watched the Adjustment Bureau, and I thought that there have never been two leads who had better chemistry than the two of them.
Sure.
And now I'm just wondering if it's just Emily Blunt, because she has chemistry with even her dorky-ass husband. So, wow. I'm not kidding. Like, she hasn't... The chemistry between them in that movie is unbelievable.
She really can't have chemistry with anybody.
Sure.
She's incredible.
Yeah. Her and Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Where you're just a guy who, by the way, as we've discussed, doesn't always have great chemistry with people.
No. Very often doesn't.
No,
very
he does
often
not.
Doesn't. Can I just make a point
about the tech real quick?
Please.
To rebut my colleague Clay. I think
you're not going to tell me that tech is possible in 1999. It's not.
Certainly that's just not. An objective I don't give a fuck whether it's possible or not. That is certainly
is
not a part of my
interest.
don't care about the efficacy of the realism of the 1999 internet movie. But essentially what I will say that what I found really interesting and find interesting each time I watch this movie is how I definitely think that there's sort of, and this might just be rambling, but I think that there's an interesting prescience to the way Ewan McGregor's character develops through just the voyeurism of watching somebody through either a computer screen or through a camera. you know, I kind of think that there's this sort of, I don't know, bizarre, like, I don't know, there's an interesting precursor to the commentary about people that just are there to watch things. And I just kind of stopped and thought about how the internet has developed in the 22 years since this movie has come out, and how so many fucking weird, freaky people have been created just literally by, you know, this type of guy, that I feel like Ewan McGregor kind of plays a creep in this movie. And yes, that's sort of an interesting aspect.
But it's not presented that way. It's like sweet at the end. They present him as a, her last line is this like loving, oh, it was you. Like,
here's what
thing.
I'm going to say. I will say this about the ending. Okay, look, the ending is bad. I understand that. And here's the thing. Like, you know, if you're watching this for the first time, I don't know. It depends on who you are. You're either going to get like Kenny, check out from the beginning, or I think you'll get to the end and be like, wow, I watched this entire movie and then I don't know. I mean, the ending is really bad. And I've heard, you know, that Stephen Elliott has said, yeah, we screwed up the ending. I mean, it's just not a good ending in any type of resolution. They finally are together. They finally meet. She sort of alludes that he's his guardian angel and that, you know, she sort of thanks him and that's it. It's over. She you know, flies off the side of the road. And you're not even sure whether it's a suicidal move or whether she, you know, just literally lost control of the vehicle. So it's just poorly edited. It's poorly written. It's poorly done. And if you're looking at this movie kind of as a form of like of a parable, it doesn't tie anything up. And I think that that's where it ultimately fails. Okay, I'll give you that. Fine.
I do, Kenny, do you think this is the worst last line of 1999? Because I think it might be up there.
No, I mean, I can't remember any other last lines.
As she lays there dying, she says, "I wish you love." And then
I wish you love.
It's bad. It's a bad last
look,
line.
Terrible.
Most last lines are bad. The only ever good last line was from Sully. So aside from that, they all stink.
Was it
they
Bert? All stink.
I would do it in June.
I hate the ghost daughter in this movie as much as I hate anything in any movie. But how does she not come back at the end? How is she like out on the snow somewhere and then she like disappears? Like he's letting go of his
even
obsession.
Inception had the ghost kids
like,
come back.
If you're gonna have this idiot device, at least like the ghost bring it back around at the end and give it resolution.
The ghost kid in Fury Road.
Yeah.
I would have had.
I'll give you all that.
I would have figured out a way.
Ghost kid should have come back.
So I think I would have had Ashley Judd be his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, you're like, you see them together for the first time from her perspective. And he's not Ewan McGregor. He's actually like Terrence Stamp. He's actually like 30 years older.
By the way, that's a better ending.
And we didn't know the whole time, but he didn't know the whole time. He just has been like in this state of, you know, how you think like you're like 21 and then all of a sudden you look in the mirror and you're like 100. Yeah. Like that's what it is to him. Like he still thinks he is like in this like hot young Obi-Wan body, but he's actually Alec Guinness.
See, I like that. I like that.
Would have been a perfect guy to play.
That would have been great.
Old Ewan.
Kenny, that's the thing. This movie needed two or three more truly insane bits
classic. That's what I'm getting at. Like, that's why I can't like get down with this idea that this movie is like funny and wacky and crazy. Like all the stuff that's like outside of the norm, it's like barely in the wrong direction. But if it went gonzo, then I would have been like, wonderful. Like you love me. You love me as a viewer because you're willing to like show me shit I've never seen before.
Yeah. Because I was thinking about the movies that Clay and Ryan have been on our podcast for.
Mm.
So only Clay, you've been on for Sea of Love.
Right.
The very thought of you.
Erotic thriller. Very
and then Ryan, you've been on for Pushing Tin and The Abyss. So it's a real spectrum that you guys have come on here for.
Right. All bangers.
We met you too late into this podcast. We've given away all the good ones. But we gave you the 89ers. We haven't great.
Those
89ers
are fucking great.
The Abyss I feel bad for Ryan that he had to do a classic.
Exactly.
But I will say, and I want to, this might seem like a strange, you know, parallel to draw, but I want to talk about comparing this to Pushing Tin is actually not that insane as far as I'm concerned. Like, okay. I think that Pushing Tin is another thing where, like, doesn't all work, doesn't stick the landing, kind of a mess, filled with people that, I think Pushing Tin's a better movie than this by a long shot. But still, I think that, like, again, it's a director that doesn't really get the material. Like, there's just a bunch, there's like a dissonance going on.
Pushing Tin is feels forever like it should have been a classic.
It should have been a fucking great movie.
Yeah.
It's a great concept for a movie, goddammit. But all that being said, I just think it's interesting. And then with Sea of Love, which I feel like also kind of has some parallels to this a little bit, a much better movie. But like, again, sort of this, I wish he wasn't a spy, because I think that's, we don't need him to be a fucking spy in this movie. I actually think it hurts the movie that he's a spy. Yeah. Like, it should be just so much more terrestrial, so much more just like grounded. It should be just about a guy who's just like clearly lost touch with either as a bad cop.
I like
or
it better
whatever.
Than most spy movies I've seen, to be honest.
Well, sure, because it doesn't really feel like a spy movie. That's why you like
no,
spy
yeah.
And I hate most spy movies. Right.
But do you know what I'm getting at? That, like, if this was just a little bit more boots on the ground, grimy, like, I kind of think I might have been able to ride for it a little bit more. But it's just, like, the tone, it's such a weird tonal mishmash of things that, again, like I said, doesn't make it necessarily a bad movie. But to Kenny's point, then it needs to really fucking go gonzo. And it needs to go real crazy.
I guess so. Except that, again, like, what I would still say is that we don't live in a place anymore where you can make a sort of not boring, but bad movie. Like, I kind of think we don't live there. We either make a quote unquote, I'm making a bad movie, which means it's either fucking horrifically boring. And with all due respect, Kenny, I think you're the only one at this table that thought this movie was boring.
That's okay. I feel respected.
Yeah, I'm just saying we that, like, you know, this movie to me is not, it's anything but boring. Like, I think it's bad for sure. But I love that there was a time and where we could do this, where somebody could, like, spectacularly fail, and yet it was kind of gorgeously done with pretty good actors, with sort of interesting and kind of fascinating set pieces and weird mise-en-scene. There was an experimental quality that, of course, yes, this fails. But I just think that nowadays we don't have that opportunity anymore. And I think that that's where great art will eventually come out of, our failures that are interesting failures. And I love those types of movies. Those are definitely things.
This just doesn't fall into that category for me. You're speaking a language that I understand. But this just, like, the reason that they didn't go more gonzo is because they didn't think they were making a gonzo movie.
No,
but again, why they're not intending to make a gonzo movie.
That's what I'm telling you.
Right.
I agree. That's what I just said. I said the reason they didn't go gonzo is because they didn't think they were making a gonzo movie. That's why I don't like it, because I don't think that this movie set out to be I don't think this movie set out to be fun. I think this movie set out to be great. And I think when you set out to be great and you miss the mark, it's
a bummer. To me, I hear that.
Yeah, to me as a viewer, sometimes I can feel like my intelligence has been insulted a little bit.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened during the course of this movie. Over and over again. I really think that's what it was. I think you kept getting the trappings and, like, the what's the word? Kind of the match, whatever. The trappings of a great ambitious film with no there. And that's
this movie is bad, and yet it's almost not bad enough to get to that place of, like, cult status. Like, we can't just breeze past the fact that Steven kicks the shit out of a blind man and screams at him, "She's gonna kill you." Like, there are moments.
And then later
in this movie,
is the one who kills him.
Yeah.
I could see, like, there are periods during the course of this podcast where I started to, like, make the contrarian argument in my head, the argument I would make on the Razzies podcast for why this is actually a classic. But
for, like, say, Color of Night. Like for A Color of Night?
Yes, like Color of Night.
Yeah, yeah,
where I came into it and be like, okay, let's give this movie the benefit of every doubt. Uh-huh. And I got there with Color of Night, as you know.
Yes, you did.
I don't think this is that kind of film. Like, no. I think that that's kind of what I... Where I think that's exactly like where I'm where yeah. the gulf is for me.
Can I also say, yeah, Kenny, I think that there's also a distinction that you I definitely get the feeling that you walked into this thinking that it was a quote unquote erotic thriller. And I don't think that that's what they are intending to make.
I thought this was a serial killer movie. I mean, like,
really?
Because yeah, it was on your serial killer draft.
That's all I knew about it was that it was a serial killer movie. Yes, because it was discussed on your draft.
Sure.
And that it was a little wacky. And I envisioned something not necessarily sexier. I envisioned something darker. Like I envisioned something like literally darker, right? Like literally like more like Murder by Numbers, you know?
Uh-huh. It sometimes goes there though. Like when she murders that guy up top,
it's pretty shocking.
And she's naked on the fucking pier.
It's a great kill.
It's a great kill. And she takes off the wig. Like there's stuff. Like when that happened, I was like, okay. Like I'm paying attention, but you never get there again. Really, like that scene with the cop, which I still think is insane. Where the cop shows up, he just walks, saddles in there, shows her his badge. And then, like, she's in fucking full-on lingerie, and then she just shoots him. Also, I just want to say for a second.
Ryan, why would Kenny think this is an erotic thriller?
But hold on.
Where would he get that notion?
Ewan McGregor's character is either of two things. He's either laconic and barely, like, emoting anything, or he is shocked and utterly, like, out of his mind insane that she's done something like kill a person or shoot somebody in cold blood, even though he's seen her do it several times already. Like, it's just, it's very, very hard to wrap your head around these characters.
Yeah.
You guys want to talk about Jason Priestley?
Yes. That is the next person I want to talk about. Yeah. So Jason Priestley shows up as a drug addict named Gary, who picks her up on the side of the road because her car has broken down. He tries to seduce her. He's got total bleach blonde, spiky, fucking NSYNC hair. He's got this crazy, like, what would you? He looks like Ed Hardy meets the Guy Fieri kind of thing. Like, he's got this weird sort of energy to him.
With that Jason Priestley face,
right? Like a scummy guy. He tries to seduce her. She rebuffs him. He knocks her unconscious, beats the shit out of her, and injects her with heroin. I mean, okay. And then before he's about to rape her, Ewan McGregor comes in and beats the shit out of him. It feels like Jason Priestley just like really pushing against type, right? Like just dialing it up to 11 and being like, I am not Dylan McKay anymore. Was he Dylan McKay? The fuck was his character's name?
Brandon.
The other one. Brandon. Sorry.
Brandon Walsh.
Brandon Walsh. Sorry. But I got to say, kind of walked into something. Stumbled into something, I feel like.
It's great.
Right,
totally down with Jason Priestley.
He's fantastic, and he kind of steals the movie. He's got that one great part, and you know, yeah, he totally kills it. And I think he was sort of there's Love and Death in Long Island. Was that the other movie he made at that time? What was that movie called that he made with John
Love and
Hurt?
Death in Long Island.
Yeah, it's so good,
He's good in that. Yeah.
And I kind of think he was kind of, you know, this was a bit of a little Renaissance period for him. And he's fantastic, and he's slimy and gross. And does all the things you want from a character like this.
He definitely is a bright spot. I mean, just to be abundantly clear, similar to Kenny,
I also like the blind guy. I really like him too.
Is he? Why do I know that actor? I know him from something.
Yeah, I can't remember his name, but he's in a lot of things.
Burgeon or something like that.
Yes.
He was really good too. This is one of those movies, and I do empathize or agree with Kenny in the sense that like I wasn't like locked into this film from credits to credits by any means, but like there were pockets and things that popped, and like Priestley popped. I thought that first kill really popped. Like there are things that certainly kind of made it jump off the screen a little bit for me. Yeah. And then there was just stuff that was so bad that I was just like, this is crazy. I'm just amazed that this exists. But
I still, look, I think Priestley did exactly what he was supposed to do.
Yeah.
Don't necessarily understand why that scene was necessary. I think that scene, you know what kind of messed me up a little bit? Because first of all, it's like, not throwing shade your way, Phil, but like he didn't just beat her up. Like it was like graphic, right? Like it it made me think of the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And it's not a particularly different scenario. It is a man beating up a horrible woman. And I think we can say like Ashley Judd may have her reasons, but once you start killing people on a serial basis, you're a pretty horrible person. Right. And why in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that was such a valedictory moment, mm-hmm. And somewhat cathartic, and why in this it was so revolting and disgusting. And this is the scene I think of when I say the movie had no sense of where empathy lies. And everything about that scene seemed like it existed just to ingratiate Ashley Judd's character with the audience in a way that I felt was unearned and extremely unearned, considering this like over the top scene to get us on the murderer's side. Mm-hmm. It felt really exploitative and out of place and super uncomfortable. And
it just didn't need to be that graphic. Like on some level, it's just like, I understand, but
there's a movie where that scene plays.
Sure.
Right. There's a movie that's about that is about violence and intimacy and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And male on female violence within the confines of a room that no one else is allowed in. There's ideas that could be played out there, but I don't think that was the purpose. I think the purpose was simply to, recalibrate your empathy meter mm-hmm. back towards this woman. And it made me uncomfortable as a viewer. It took me to a place where I'm like, now I feel like you're lost, Stephen.
Well, the third act of this film, I would argue, is all about that recalibration for all intents and purposes. It feels like from the Jason Priestley point onward, you're trapping her at this diner with her psychiatrist and some cops, and then like her on the run, and then this kind of melodramatic final chase between them, and then like her dying in his arms. Like all of this is meant to feel tragic in some way. And I'm just like, but it's like, it's kind of crazy though.
It is like, it is, you take it in final analysis, it is tragic. Like I can understand how she's a very tragic character.
Sure.
But like, he's the villain and he doesn't get that ending. He doesn't deserve that ending. There's, that's not how this is supposed to go at the end. But the whole thing.
So
it's an emotional mess. I talked to the whole Pierce Priestley part. Do you guys have feelings on this?
Yeah, he had some personality to him. So that part of the movie was slightly more interesting.
Well said.
Can I just say something? I'm looking at a trivia bit in IMDb, and mm-hmm. I feel like it really is sort of like a key to maybe what is the problem and what I love also about this movie.
Okay.
Director Stephen Elliott fought the film's financier, Mark Damon, over the tone of the film. Elliott envisioned the film as a dark thriller with sex and random lashings of violence. Damon wanted a more A to B thriller that it could sell worldwide. Ironically, many of the Asian markets that bought the film wanted a sexier and more violent version of the film. I feel like this movie was never made. This movie was made, but it was never really made. It was not the movie that obviously he had envisioned. It was clearly a many, many, many compromises in this movie. And I feel like this is such a like classic 90s story of, random financiers, becoming producers for one movie only, or maybe two or three, and, kind of dictating things like their Robert Evans, thus eliminating, everybody thinks they're Harvey Weinstein in 1998, 1999. And mm-hmm. I think that may be part of the problem, because Stephen Elliott bears a lot of regret and sadness and shame about Eye of the Beholder, so much to the point that he did not make a movie for so long after this.
Well, I'm just looking at his filmography,
and I just think that that's
to your point.
That's got to be a part of the story as well, because I definitely think that there's a movie that was lost here that we're lamenting.
So. Well, he does Eye of the Beholder in 1999. He does a movie called Easy Virtue, which is based on a Noel Coward play starring Jessica Biel, Colin Firth, and Kristin Scott Thomas, I guess came out in 2009 and it made $20 million. So,
pretty good movie. Remake of an old Hitchcock film.
Oh, okay.
And he does not, a movie called
A Few Best Men, which I don't know of, but that kind of was released in Australia. He's an Australian filmmaker. Rio, I Love You in 2014 is a movie that I guess it's one of those anthology films. And then Swinging Safari in 2017.
That sounds awesome.
Ooh, Guy Pearce, Kylie Safari. Minogue, okay. Very Australian.
Very down under.
Ryan,
I think you're right. I think there is a better movie here.
Clearly. I mean, just think of what he said. A dark thriller with sex and random lashings of violence. You see how all of that is hinted throughout the course of this movie. It's all there. We are all wanting all of what he just described, and we don't really get it. And, you know, that's such a, like, failure of the movie, for sure.
I think it's incumbent upon us to hate this movie.
Yeah.
Well, I think it should also be said too, like, it's based on a book. He adapts the book. There's a part of me that feels like clearly he feels passionate about this film, clearly feels as though this is going to put him in a different lane as a filmmaker. It's going to change the perception of him, which, you know, more power to him for that. I agree with you. It seems like the financiers were nudging him in a direction that he unfortunately felt he had to go. So the movie's sort of pulled in two directions, which obviously is never a good thing. But again, like, listen, this is a strange movie. I would argue, Kenny, one of the strangest movies we've done this year. And by that, I mean just a movie that doesn't really feel like it has a POV, that feels like it's kind of all over the place. Pretty big movie stars at the time.
It feels vaguely tragic. Now that Ryan read that quote, now the whole thing feels a little tragic. Now I feel like now it feels a bit.
That's right.
A bit feel morose. Shame, Kenny. Now I feel like everything I said I feel like stands, and I was 100% correct.
Sure.
But I put it at the feet of the wrong guy, and I feel terrible about it.
Well, I think this is interesting because We're in the final run of this podcast. You know, we're in the last year of it. All the movies that are on this list are movies that have been on our list for a very long time, right? So we're in a strange period of like a bunch of weird movies mixed with like fucking stone cold classics, like your Being John Malkovich's and your Fight Clubs and your Magnolias, right? So in between the stretches between these great films, we have strange patches of films. And I'm kind of enjoying it. I don't know about you, Kenny, but like it's kind of a weird pocket that we're in now of 99.
We are in a weird fucking pocket.
We're
in the weirdest fucking pocket you guys could imagine. Because it's
don't even
all
know the shit we're watching.
It's like it's all the movies that, well, one, no one wanted to do. It's the movies we didn't want to do. But they generally even like, I mean, we did Twin Falls, Idaho, which we loved.
Good movie.
But most of them are these offbeat,
strange
movies that like kind of seem unwelcoming when you put them on in the beginning, alienating. Yeah. And you'll see, Phil, Sympatico falls in that category. And I'm guessing Goodbye Lover does too.
Yes.
Because a lot of them deal with low-level crime. Just all seems like this like street-level crime. Not people who are particularly good at crime. Yeah. Not just this low-level, like, down and dirty crime shit.
But what's funny about that...
I just want to finish, the runoff of the early 90s, you know, Quentin Tarantino specifically, like early stuff, Reservoir Dogs, True Romance, that runoff that gave us good movies like Usual Suspects and gave us some like really horrible nightmare movies like some of the stuff we're watching.
But also mixed into that, though, we still have to do Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which also fits into that, right? Like it's also part of that milieu to some degree or another.
It definitely is. Now it's a good version of that, but yeah.
Right. But it's just, we're in a strange pocket. I want to rate this film because I'm very curious to hear what you guys think possibly about the film we're covering next week. I'm not sure if you guys have seen it, but I'm curious here if you have and what your thoughts are on it. So let's rate this movie. Ryan, you saw this in 99, correct?
That's right.
So So let's start with you. What did you think in 99? What did you think before the podcast? What do you think after the podcast?
In 99, I would have given this movie 2 stars.
Okay.
Out of what?
0 to 99.
We do 0 to 99.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Then I would say I would have given this, about a 40%. I'd give it 40 points.
Sure.
Now I definitely put it in the 60s realm. I'd say 60 to 65, somewhere around there.
I love you, Ryan Barker. Just,
on pure you enjoyment are... level, I'm not thinking about this. Hey, I'm not caring.
You do what you need
this.
To do. No, it's just our podcast.
I just think it's great. You are an X factor. You are always the you will zig when we think you'll zag, and that's fantastic. What about you, Clay?
Okay, so I did not see this in 99. When I saw it like 6 months ago, because it was the third suggested you might like this after I watched Twisted on Amazon Prime.
A better or worse Ashley Judd performance?
Well, she has a character in Twisted. So I would say Twisted is better. No, Twisted's a better movie. Twisted is a weird. Have you guys seen Twisted?
I have not seen Twisted.
I was on a run where I watched in like 3 nights in a row. I watched like Jennifer 8 and then Twisted.
Jennifer 8's good.
That was Garcia. So I watched Garcia was Jennifer 8. That brought me to Twisted. And then Twisted brought me to Eye of the Beholder through the you might also like algorithm of Amazon Prime. Jennifer 8 is wild. Twisted is wild. That's another one where it's like she's a cop who has a haunted past. And all of her boyfriends are getting murdered. And is it her? Is it
Well, she had this run,
else?
Right? Like Kiss the Girls, Twisted, Double Jeopardy. Like there was kind of a run there where she was doing, right? Am I correct in Kiss the Girls?
Was Kiss the Girls the Monica Potter one?
No, that's Along Came a Spider.
Kiss the Girls was Morgan Freeman.
They're both Morgan Freeman. Kiss the Girls. I would say when
Twisted
I watched it.
Looks really good.
Twisted's a great San Francisco movie. Great and unhinged Andy Garcia performance.
Philip Kaufman too.
Yeah, no, Twisted's better than this movie. I would say that the first time I saw this, I'd put it in sort of like the mid 30s. But the second time seeing it, I'm up into where Ryan started in the 40s. Because like I said, I was not bored. And I think knowing what I was getting into, I could appreciate the sort of freeform nonsense of it more. And there are a couple of, to Ryan's point, you look at a movie that's a failure today and Dollars to Donuts, it's fucking flat. It's shot like a Kohl's commercial. Like it just, there's nothing. There's nothing worth looking at. They did it all on a fucking green screen. This, it's a failure, but you get to go to 4 or 5 different fun cities.
You go to Alaska.
You go to Alaska. You go, there's a couple of interestingly
I could take you to Alaska with some other movies. You don't need this movie.
I'm
Alaska.
Sure you could, Kenny.
Mystery Alaska, like, we could take you there.
Ever see Limbo?
The camera flies into a snow. The camera flies into a snow globe, and then it becomes that city. You know, that's the kind of thing you can only do with the movies. That's the magic of cinema.
It's the magic of movies.
And as the IMDb trivia that Ryan referenced earlier also says, the reason why the director wanted to do the movie was the scene where they're on either side of the bathroom wall. So,
he got it.
He got the scene he wanted. He shot the hell out of that scene.
It's a great shot. All right.
So I would say somewhere in the 40s.
Kenny, what about you?
I actually have one more question. And Ryan, I don't take offense to this because it falls into the efficacy of 90s technology realm.
Okay.
How did he have a camera in every room?
I don't know.
Okay, cool.
Didn't explain.
I mean, this is, in a weird way, he's almost like Lisbeth Salander in the sense of his abilities, technologically speaking.
Yeah, he has some kind of camera in the corner every room she's in.
But the surveillance stuff.
No, the ones inside. Like she saw him kill the cop.
No, you're right.
It's not that. Look,
I'm sure there was a bunch cut out of this movie. Maybe they decided they didn't need the scene where he installed the cameras. I also, on IMDb, there's promo shots on a train. And I don't remember a train sequence.
No, she's on a train.
That's the kind of thing.
Yes. And that's where she meets. Oh, what happens on the
train?
Remember,
she kills the guy. She fills the bathroom with
water. Oh, it fills the bathroom. We didn't talk about the flooded bathroom.
That's a pretty good kill. This movie
oh, was crazy
movie's,
too.
This movie's not as bad as I thought it was.
It's a weird
when
movie.
I said,
so fun.
You know, my little blurb, maybe the worst movie I've ever seen. I gave it an 8.
Ryan said, is she even a serial killer? She kills like 7 people in this movie.
That's why he liked
it. That was
it
me.
So
I said that was really you.
So I gave it an 8 before this movie. I take my ratings very seriously.
An 8 out of 99.
Correct. Yes, which would make it the 3rd worst film we did this year.
Ooh.
Wow.
But it's no longer an 8. I will definitely go like well into the teens on this one. So, I'm going to go ahead and give it an 18. I'm going to give it a 19.
Right.
I mean, just like, I think that's what it deserves. I think it's a 19 out of 99. I think it's in the lower quintile of the podcast, maybe the lower sextile, not sure, but maybe the lower septile.
I don't think it deserves to be with you know, Chill Factor.
Well, Chill Factor is a 3. It's so it doesn't. I agree with you, but it's a 19. You know, it's a 19.
How
it's
about
a bad movie.
Here's a question? How about that movie you mentioned earlier, Entrapment?
Entrapment is very low.
What was your rating for Entrapment, Kenny?
Like 15. I'll look it up.
Yeah, because I'm curious.
Entrapment is a truly terrible movie.
Like, Entrapment is the type of bad movie that I like. I feel what you feel about this,
Ryan. I'm right there with you. I gave
where
it a
it's like
rating,
so boring and
wait,
fucking,
I'm pulling it up, Kenny, because I have it on our fandom page.
It's boring. It's flat. It means nothing. It goes nowhere.
Kenny gave Entrapment a 12.
12.
Okay. So I hope this is better than 12, I think that I'm
this is
unhappy.
A 19. I think I gave
Fine.
It. I think.
Great.
I think that makes it. It's. I think Entrapment is the 3rd worst film of the year for me. Is that right?
Yeah. Baby Genius is. You have it 15.
Yes.
At First Sight, you have it 18.
These are some horrible films.
I forgot about that.
Actually, you know what? This is. I feel good about 19 now because it's better than At First Sight.
You know what? You very thought of you 17.
17. This is not. Maybe you know. It's right there. This is appropriate.
Is this better than The Very Thought of You or Martha Meet Lawrence Daniel and whatever?
You know what, Kenny? You gave Random Hearts an 11, and The Other Sister an 8. So this film's actually like beating a fair amount.
Entrapment. It beats The Story Bus. It beats Mickey Blue Eyes. It beats The Haunting. The Very Thought of You. Runaway Bride. Muppet from Space. At First Sight. It's right there with Teaching Miss Tingle, Detroit Rock City, and Instinct. So it's a terrible film.
You're right.
It's a terrible, terrible film, but like not like the worst movie I've ever seen. Those three movies I would even consider watching again. And I feel the same way. Actually, I feel the way about those movies as I do about this, which is like they didn't have to be nearly as bad as they were.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. 100%. So when I came into this, I had the film at a 19. That was my pre-podcast number. I've gone up mostly because of Ryan's just absolute passion for this film. I think that Ryan has really...
That's why I went up too, Ryan.
Like
I think Ryan also went up because of his own passion.
Ryan,
you made a great, great case, Ryan.
I talked myself up for sure.
So I'm at a 35 now. So it's gone up considerably.
Unbelievable. I feel pretty good
about that.
I want to pull up your.
Yeah,
I think Phil and I are close. I'm like low 40s.
I want to pull up your fandom now to see where this ranks or what this ranks for.
Oh,
like,
man.
You know, what's
now
in
I'm
the
gonna
neighborhood.
Be, I'm probably going to be embarrassed by how
no,
high this
I don't
is
know.
Now.
Right, you gave it a 30 because I pretty much know mine by heart, but I don't really know yours. Right, you gave it a 35.
Yeah.
The other shitty ass movies. You're more generous than me. That's the issue. American Pie, Forces of Nature, Play to the Bone. 3 horrible fucking films, and this also lives there.
This
is an ISCOPE 35. I agree.
That's perfect. That feels right. So next week, guys, we are talking about Breakfast of Champions.
Oh boy.
The Bruce Willis adaptation.
Oh wait, so Ryan, you've seen this?
Oh yeah,
and Clay, you have not.
I'm not. Hold on. I don't even know if I know what this is.
This movie
wait,
is.
Have
insane.
You heard of the Kurt Vonnegut book, Breakfast of Champions? Right, Clay.
That's a Alan Rudolph movie.
Yes, but I don't know what, just the title. I don't know anything about any of this.
So this is a movie that has essentially been scrubbed from.
Try not to say anything. You haven't seen the movie, right, Phil?
I saw a bit of it in 99. I did not finish it.
Don't say too much because I am eagerly awaiting this film.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to get into it much.
I'm 100 pages into the novel, which I never read. The novel is spectacular.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Like, spectacular. So I cannot wait to see the way this has been adapted.
But also, you've read 100 pages of it, and I think we can all safely say unadaptable, like basically the type of thing that probably shouldn't be adapted.
The thing about Vonnegut, having read, like, this is like the fifth Vonnegut novel I've read now, you should do like Castle Rock with Vonnegut's characters.
Yes.
That's like the only way that this shit would ever work.
I agree.
Because like this pulled out, it's like, I only, you know, I've read a few books. So I'm aware of Ellie Rosewater is in this. Kilgore Trout is in this.
Yeah.
His guys are in this novel, but without a cursing understanding of what these guys are doing, I'd be even more lost.
But I'm also just taking the Vonnegut cinematic universe out of this for a second. His tone, Vonnegut's voice is impossible to adapt. Like, he's such a literary voice.
Someone
it made me think in a lot of ways of, like, have you guys ever seen or heard of Even Cowgirls Got the Blues, the Tom Robbins book?
Yes.
That Gus Van Sant tried to adapt many years ago with Uma Thurman. Again, unadaptable. A voice that just cannot transcend that medium, cannot leave that medium. And there's a part of me that's like, I'm super curious to A, reread the book, B, watch this film. We have David Iserson coming on to talk about it with us, who is a big Vonnegut fan.
The very good David Iserson. And
the very good, the brilliant David Iserson. But I just think that, Ryan, do you remember the movie at all?
Yes. Oh, I've seen it a couple times. Yeah,
You don't own it by any chance, do you?
Yeah, do you have a copy
I don't own it. I do not own it.
Because that DVD is hard to find.
Yeah. I bet they have it at Cinephile, though.
I bought it on eBay.
I spent $35. I bought it on eBay, too.
Guys, I think you're going to love it, honestly. Like,
oh,
I think
wow.
It's a pretty fucking great movie. I mean, Kenny, I'm going to listen to this when you drop this.
Can I just say that, Ryan, you continue to impress by, it is not a loved movie. This is not a movie that people like. This movie is kind of loathed.
Sure.
Ryan, have you read the novel?
I have not read the novel. I will say that.
Phil,
but I loved the movie.
There's nobody on the planet Earth I know who is less aware of what the general populace thinks about a thing than Ryan Marker.
That's why you're the best, Ryan. Because you're
whenever
the Sandler
you tell him
of,
a movie that he loves is disliked, he is completely like floored and
He says the same thing every time. He goes, "Of course," like. I've never seen you. This is why this is probably why you like this movie, because you have about as much faith in humanity as Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes, totally. And on top of it, I mean, again, you've got Nolte and fucking Willis at the top of their game.
Oh, we're going Nolte back to back. Wow.
Guys, Nolte back to
guys.
Back. It's Bruce Willis, Albert Finney, Nick Nolte, Barbara Hershey, Lucas Haas,
Finney back to back.
Buck Henry.
This is wild because Finney and Nolte are both in fucking Sabatico.
Yeah.
All right. So that's
year
so funny. Right, I can't wait to watch this movie.
I wanted to watch it
from the beginning of the pod.
I'm so excited.
It's always been an interesting little piece of like trivia to me, a little curio that this like beloved novel got made into a film, and it was like a notorious,
and it doesn't exist.
A notorious disaster.
Starring Bruce Willis.
Like it's always interesting to me. You know, sometimes novels get like. Unadaptable or not, but really famous novels get made into movies. A couple that I can think of off the time that just bomb. Not even like not bomb. Don't exist. Not like fucking what's the movie that the Goldfinch, which is like a laughable joke, right?
Not like the Goldfinch. One of them is Snow Falling on Cedars, which we did.
I'm thinking more like The Road. I'm thinking like American Pastoral.
Angela's Ashes.
I'm thinking of yeah, Angela's Ashes, but like I feel like people are aware, like these movies that people were like, I can't, like America Pastoral with Ewan is a perfect example. Sure. Because for fucking 50 years, people are like, this is one of my favorite novels. I can't wait for someone to actually do this. It would be like a fucking Catcher in the Rye or Confederacy of Dunces got made and no one cared. Like that's crazy. And that's
the thing though,
Champions.
Totally. And I just want to say that from an angle that I came about it to from would be that it's Alan Rudolph. I was a huge Alan Rudolph fan who is a colleague and
work.
And a collaborator with Robert Altman, who in that same year made another movie that was reviled called Dr. T and the Women that I absolutely
love.
That's a year later. Okay, well, regardless.
Cookie's Fortune is 99, but yes.
Gotcha. Again, yeah. I love Cookie's Fortune. I love Dr. T. I love Alan Rudolph and I love Robert Altman. And
I'm looking at his filmography right now, and he's not a filmmaker that I've seen a lot of. I've seen Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle. I've seen Afterglow.
Yes.
Great movies. But he's kind of just, he's done
Watch
a bunch
Choose
of movies.
Watch Choose Me. Choose Me, speaking of Genevieve.
So anyway. I'd be interested. Can you guys remember a novel that was considered unadaptable that was adapted successfully?
An English Patient. Wasn't that considered unadaptable?
Yeah. English Patient is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. Because I read that book after seeing the movie and I was just like, it's poetry, basically. It's like, I don't understand. And it's all told from the opposite perspective. It's all told from Jesus Christ, Juliette Binoche's character. So like, it's completely flipped. But yeah, there are a lot of books that I feel like, and we've talked about this a little bit, Kenny, off mic, just in general, but like, I do think that television has opened essentially the floodgates to all books now, because now you can do a limited of a book that shouldn't be
Which generally is the right way to do a novel. Absolutely.
Well, that's like The Goldfinch is a prime example of that, where it's like how that wasn't an HBO miniseries, you know, is absolutely beyond me. But instead they, you know.
There's been so many, it's a double-edged sword. There've been so many incredible movies like The Godfather, which comes from a novel. It's obviously possible to do it in 2.5-3 hours or 6 hours, but whatever. It's obviously possible to do it. It happens over and fucking over again. Dr. Zhivago. But no one wants to really do it anymore. I think movies like The Goldfinch are why people are stopping now.
Well, and because also
I think it's the TV stuff. Sorry to.
That's what I mean. Shitty novels like Big Little Lies become Emmy plays, fairly brilliant novels, but like The Goldfinch, become punchlines.
Yep.
Yes, and also they are, you know, kind of Pandora's box that it's like you could really fuck up, you know, if you pull this off. And I have to say, Vonnegut, and especially this particular one, I think you know it has a tone that is so not. I wouldn't say it's not filmable, but I would also say that it's not exactly palatable. It's not something people normally do. I mean, it's very
so specific.
Very specific. It's very small, but also very, witty and tight and interesting, and you need great performance to do it. I would, to answer your question, Kenny, I would say that the last big swing that I can remember is Inherent Vice, doing Pynchon.
Yes!
And pulling that off. Whether you like the movie or not, I definitely think, you know, tackling Pynchon and then pulling that off, I think is a big swing.
Yeah, everybody was afraid to touch him forever and ever, all of his shit. And it was kind of an amazing, that's a great example of this. And that's, you know, like I would really, there was a Slaughterhouse Five movie made. I don't know anything about it. Yeah. And it's true for Philip Roth too, which is weird, but I really would love to see some fucking excellent A-list brilliant auteurs.
Well, I mean, Plot Against America was great, but I know what you're saying.
Was that? Plot Against America
was great.
A show.
Yes.
I, you know, like the Roth movies, American Pastoral and Goodbye Columbus
Human Stain is a Roth
movie, are pretty much forgotten by history. Yeah. And I would love to see someone of Paul Thomas Anderson's caliber or Greta Gerwig, like what she did with fucking Little Women, take on some of these really difficult to adapt pieces. And I actually think Breakfast of Champions works as a movie potentially better than a TV show.
For sure.
But I mean, also like, Cats Cradle is a movie. Cats Cradle works.
Well, he's but Noah Hawley had the rights. He tried to do it as an FX show, and they just killed that relatively.
But I would just say the last thing about the last thing about Breakfast of Champions, which I can't wait to see. If you're feeling not that great about America right now, it is the novel for you.
I'm very excited to read it. I'm very excited to reread it. I'm excited to watch this film. But more importantly, Clay, Ryan.
Yes.
You guys are the
absolute,
kings.
The kings, the Screen Drafters themselves. Everyone should be listening to your podcast.
Including
if they have
you.
All the time in the world. they should be listening to your podcast. It is fantastic. You guys are the best. We love having you on for these odd films.
We love being on. If there's any more odd films, the odder the better. If you can find something that's worse,
don't you worry.
Okay, all right.
I am with Clay on this. Only bring me on for these ones that you're like. No, we don't have anybody for that.
You want to watch? You want to watch? You want to watch?
Simpatico.
Simpatico in the next couple of days.
I know Simpatico up here.
Ryan can do Simpatico.
Have you seen Simpatico?
Of course I have. This is my year. I watch every movie.
So come on, please come on the pod for
Simpatico.
We'll put it. We'll drop it in June. So we'll
done. Isn't that two in a row?
It's Sam Shepard.
It is Sam Shepard.
Nick Nolte. Sam Shepard.
If you need a guy, if you need a Shepard,
it's Sam Shepard's play, is what you're saying, which it is. He's not in the movie, but it's Sharon Stone, Catherine Keener.
Ryan, we have a lot of stuff we're watching for our podcast. Podcast in the next week. Can we do this in like 2 weeks?
Let's do it. Let's do it down the road a little bit. Okay. I don't want to.
We've got to watch the Oceans movie.
We got to watch all the Oceans movies. I got to watch Lego movie.
Well, it's fine. We'll push it down the road. We'll do Simpatico with you guys. It'll be great. Kenny and I will find some other fucking movie to watch together. But again, truly, you guys are the best. You're the best in the game. We can't wait to have you both on our Patreon as well. Ryan, I'm going to reach out to you because 2009, I'm sure, has some bangers that you would love to talk about that only you would want to talk about. So there's that.
Is The Reader 2009?
No, us watch
that's a bummer.
Reader.
Still haven't seen The Reader.
Clay's going to come on, obviously, to talk about Adventureland with us, and it's going to be fantastic.
Oh, it's
going
to be an honor.
We're going to talk about K-Stew for 10 hours, and it's going to be great. Yeah.
Fantastic. Just so that I don't spend a lot of time staring at the phone.
Sure.
Do you already have somebody for New Moon?
No.
Okay.
You
know we love that.
All right.
which one of the trajectory is New Moon?
It's the second one. It's hands down the best one.
I would just have to watch two we should do New Moon. I think that's
important. Yeah, we have to do New Moon.
Guys, you have to. Sure.
Yeah.
And it's incredible.
Tell the story of 2009 without Twilight Part 2, New Moon.
Kenny's never seen any of
you truly can't.
Oh,
Kenny, you're going to love these movies.
You really are going to like them.
You know, my daughter, have I told real fast?
You haven't told us.
Last anecdote.
Yeah, great.
Have I told you my daughter, who's 9, has seen them, and she has one crush, and it's young Taylor Lautner. And she always specifies. It's funny. It's not because I took her to task. I'm so proud of her. I'm like, Taylor Lautner is your guy. I wanted her to watch Twilight with me when we were doing the Razzies draft, right? She's like, I've already seen it, Dad. I'm not into it. I'm like, come on, just watch it with me. And she's like, no, I don't, Dad. I don't want to. I'm like, but he's like your crush. And she's like, young Taylor Lautner. I'm like, Layla, he was young in that movie. She's like, no. I mean, like when he was like Shark Boy. I'm like,
Shark Boy.
So like 11-year-old is her guy, which is like totally acceptable.
Adorable.
Totally into that.
That's adorable.
Taylor Lautner from the Twilight.
No.
Right.
Or real old man from Home Team, a Happy Madison movie. That's good.
Jesus Christ. Thank you guys for coming on. This was great. Can't wait to listen to every episode of your podcast. And we're going to talk Simpatico. So
and also, absolutely. Clay, I'm pretty sure when you said Grown Ups 2 has gotten a reevaluation from Film Twitter in recent years, you were talking about me.
Yeah, you're absolutely part of it. Yeah, no.
no, I was it. That's me.
Thank you, guys. I've heard that in a few different places.
Both you suckers put it on your predictions. Because of me.
Because thank you led us astray, Kenny.
No, it's such a good movie. Phil, that's a good movie, right? You would admit that.
Grown-ups, they're fine.
They're fine. Not good. Grown-ups, too, very good.
Always love
should,
coming.
We should let Kay go.
Go. Do you still got the producer? Yeah. Guys, always a pleasure to have you on Screen Drafts. Always a pleasure joining you here.
Oh, the best.
Had a great time. If you're a podcast like It's 1999 fan, which I'm assuming you are because that's the podcast we're on right now, you can check out Phil and Kenny have done two drafts together.
We have.
Or have you done two together? Just the one together?
Two together.
Two together. Bruckheimer and one Razzies. Separate.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Bruckheimer, Razzies. Kenny was on our baseball mini mega draft. Phil has done a couple others. He did Winona Ryder. And it was just when Winona Ryder.
Just Winona Ryder. And then Winona I co-commissioned with you.
That's right. That's right. Yes. So you can hear Phil and Kenny on our show. They're going to be doing an episode coming up in a month or two as well.
I completely forgot about that.
I did not, but it's time to start watching.
I was just thinking, God, there's so many
movies. Big topic. You guys are doing, can we reveal it? Do we want to reveal it?
Oh, it's fine with me.
Because I don't think that Ryan knows this.
I don't know.
Ryan's going to love this. Hotel and motel movies.
Oh. Ryan.
That's so good.
Ryan, I would so love good. Don't put your thumb on the scale.
Okay.
But maybe throw some our way.
Okay. Kenny's fielding suggestions.
Because it is such a massive fucking list. And I really want to do it justice, right? I really want to go from Grand Hotel forward, right? But like, you know, there are motel and hotel movies that come out every single year.
No, it's right? Big. It's a
particularly
because
we're doing motels too. That's half the fucking indie movies that are made.
Guys, this is a great topic.
Yeah. But we'll talk about narrowing the parameters, but I'm thinking like movies where it's either part of the plot that they're always at the hotel or motel, or the hotel or motel is like a character in the movie. So I think it's not
like Hotel Transylvania would count.
Yes, Transylvania would count. Yes,
but not Hotel Transylvania 3 where they're on the cruise ship.
No, not it's not a cruise. No, not a cruise ship.
Here's a question, genuinely: No Country for Old Men. Is that a motel movie?
No.
Motel movie?
No.
Okay. That's my point. There's like a significant sequence in a hotel or a motel, but I would not count that.
Yeah.
That's my point. I want to make sure that's not part of the equation.
There's a percentage There's a percentage.
I think it was the, I think it's the Home Alone 2 line.
I think it needs to be more than Home Alone.
More than Home Alone 2.
Yeah.
Then you
count
it.
That's a good line. That's a good
place. That is good.
That's
a good, I like that.
That's a good one. Okay. Yeah. All right.
That's basically 50%.
Guys, this is going to be a great draft.
It's going to be a great draft. And it's across all genres and all sizes of movie, too. There's some that are huge and some that are like tape where it's just like one room.
I am going to fucking Ryan Marker out on this. So Psycho, take a hike-o.
Okay. The Shining. Oh my God!
You're out of your fucking
mind if you don't think that those two movies deserve to be in this draft.
Florida Blog Project.
Is this a mini major, by the way? Or is
I can't
this like
believe a, that that was the first time I've ever heard Kenny say, "Go get your shine box." By the way, I feel like
is this a how many? Is this a mini major or is this?
Get us one.
This is a seven, baby.
Let's get us one more guy.
This is a seven. We're making this as hard as possible.
Ryan, get in this. Come on, let's do this. Make the case. Get in this.
Psycho, take a hike. I'm just dwelling on that.
Identity.
Oh, Identity's great.
Identity will make the list.
1408. That's an
preemptive number.
It is a lot of horror, I guess.
Yeah, it's a lot of horror.
I've never seen Grand Hotel. I need to do that.
I have
great California suite.
Dude, even good. What's the
California suite? Good one.
We're getting so much content out of this episode. We just did the fucking motel hotel draft in the last 5 minutes, and you guys already did your Breakfast of Champions episode. Just clip that thing. Ryan talked for 15 minutes. Just clip that.
I really want to be extensive when it comes to the hotel motel thing, but let's think really like we might not need both hotels and motels because, you know, you get it.
It's a lot.
We should go. But this was great. We
always a blast.
Can't wait to do this stuff.
You're
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.